Sundays on KPFT. The sun comes up with the Blues Cats Lounge at 6, with Boyd Bluestein. At 8 it's Mrs. V's Blues. At 11 it's the Blues Brunch with Blues King Nuri Nuri. The Blues Hound takes over at 2 with Howling the Blues. To round up Blues Sundays, it's Clint Broussard with Blues in Hi-Fi. A great day of blues, Sundays here on KPFT.
This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM.
And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices. This week, Brian Levinka talks with Avery Bellew, CEO of the Montrose Center, about an event called Out for Good on Saturday, October 5th.
It is at the Marriott Marquis, which is the first time for us. This is a bigger venue, which we're really excited about. So we're stepping it up a notch, which means that more folks can join us. We've always sold out the event, so we're excited to have a larger venue and welcome more guests.
Cleve Jones is a well-known human rights activist, author, and lecturer. He is currently celebrating his 70th birthday in October, and Deborah Moncrief Bell has a conversation with him about his life and that special birthday celebration.
It's a fundraiser for two organizations I co-founded, the National AIDS Memorial, which is the Quilt, and the AIDS Memorial Grove in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. And, of course, the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, which is our primary HIV/AIDS service provider, prevention education campaign.
Brett Cullum has a conversation with actress Cheryl McCollum, mainly about the Stages Houston show called The Legend of Ruth Brown. And we have news wrap from This Way Out. Queer Voices starts now.
This is Brian Levinka, and today I have the honor of interviewing Avery Bellew, the CEO of the Montrose Center. Welcome to Queer Voices, Avery.
Thank you, Brian.
I know that you have a lot of stuff going on at the Montrose Center, but you do have an event coming up called Out for Good. Can you talk about the Montrose Center, what they do, and then a little bit about Out for Good?
The Montrose Center is Houston's LGBTQ center. We've been serving Houston since 1978. And we do a lot, as you know. Our programs go from youth to seniors and everyone in between. And our mission is to empower our community to lead healthier and more fulfilling lives.
And so the Out for Good is coming up in October. I think it's on October 5th. Is that right?
That's correct. October 5th.
And where is it being held?
It is at the Marriott Marquis, which is the first time for us. This is a bigger venue, which we're really excited about. So we're stepping it up a notch, which means that more folks can join us. We've always sold out the event, so we're excited to have a larger venue and welcome more guests.
Can you talk about who you're honoring at the Out for Good?
We actually have two honorees this year, which is really exciting. We have an award that we've given since 2015, which is the LGBTQ Plus Visionary Award. And we're giving that award to Greg Ju, which is such a well-deserved honor. Greg, as folks know, is the founder and the editor-in-chief of Outsmart magazine, and has been in that role for more than 30 years. And Outsmart is such a crucial part of our community, keeping us connected, keeping us informed, helping us to advocate for our community. So we're really excited to give that award to Greg. And then this year, we're actually launching a brand new award, which I'm especially excited about. This is the LGBTQ Plus Innovator Award. And this is designed to recognize someone who's made a large impact on the community, who have created positive change and growth within our movement for the LGBTQ Plus community. And so the inaugural recipient this year is Ian Haddock of The Normal Anomaly. And we're so excited to honor Ian for all of the amazing work that he is doing here in Houston and beyond.
I think those are two very well deserving honorees for this award, or these awards.
I agree.
Can you tell me about, I guess you've been in your role for about a year. Is that about right?
Oh my goodness. No, it's actually 7 months. So it feels like a year sometimes, which is a good thing, I think. But only 7 months.
So can you talk about the role and what maybe you didn't expect about Houston? And
yeah, absolutely. There have been many very pleasant surprises. So, you know, I would just start by saying it is such an honor to lead the Montrose Center. It has such a fantastic history, which I'm still continuing to learn, and such an amazing community of people who are so deeply invested in all that it's done, all that it's doing, and in its future. I think the things that have surprised me most is, first of all, and I think I shared this with you perhaps the first time I was on the show, just the vastness of what the center offers and what we do for our community. I think that the center has not historically done a really great job of letting folks know everything that we do. And we do so much. So we're starting to get better at that. I'm really excited for us to even improve our ability to communicate to our community all that we offer so that folks can avail themselves of it. But that's been the first really big surprise. You know, the second I would offer is, and this is a really pleasant surprise, just how deeply collaborative the Houston LGBTQ plus community is at large. I have been so pleased by how excited folks are to come together around ideas, to try new ways of doing things, to connect and collaborate and say, hey, let's work on something together. There's a real innovative spirit in our queer community here. And that has, I don't think it's unique to Houston, perhaps it lives other places too, but I would say in my experience, I see it in a unique way in Houston. And that has been a really pleasant surprise.
I saw on Facebook that you posted that you're liking Houston. Talk about that.
I am, you know, for a lot of the reasons that I just told you, you know, first of all, it just is a really great city for all the reasons that many of us love to live here, right? It's got walkable neighborhoods, which is not always very common for Texas, right? We've got great food, great entertainment. The arts are fantastic here, but really it is about the people, and that is our community at large. And then I also have to say, of course, to brag a little bit on my staff are really extraordinary. They are folks who are kind of the top of their game, really experts in their field. And our city is so lucky to have all of these dedicated professionals that are such experts in our community very specifically. So really, it's the people that make this place so special and that brings a big smile to my face because of getting to live here.
I absolutely agree. I love Houston and I love the people. And like I said before, Houston is a fungus. It grows on you.
In the best way possible.
in a good way. Yes.
Yeah.
So let's get back to the gala. What can people expect at the gala who haven't been before?
Yeah. So, well, I will say this is my first time too. So we're going to get to experience it for the first time together, but I do have the inside track. So I know a little bit about what's coming up. We describe this as our most elegant evening. This is Houston's premier LGBTQ event and has been so for the last 11 years. So what you can expect is seeing folks that you love and respect from our community up on the stage, seeing beautiful entertainment highlighting the diversity of our community. And we'll be making announcements across the next several weeks about the entertainment that you'll see on the stage, a room full of folks that you know and love to enjoy being together and celebrating together. And an after party too, that will be lots of fun with a DJ and some entertainment. So lots of different ways that we'll get to network with each other, celebrate the mission of the Montrose Center, connect with each other, and really come together around our shared vision for the future of the center and the future of LGBTQ Houston.
And speaking of the future of the center, I saw that you just hired Kelly Nichols as the director of development. Is that right?
We did. I am so lucky. We are so lucky that Kelly said yes to coming to the center. You know, of course, she has very big shoes to fill. Kennedy was such an important part of our mission. Before Kennedy's retirement, we knew that Kelly was likely going to be the person who we hired, and Kennedy gave his blessing. Kennedy and Kelly have gotten to connect, which is wonderful. So she has his support. And she's such a fantastic member of the community. She already is known to so many folks within our community because of her work at Allies in Hope and at the Houston Grand Opera. And so we're so excited for her vision. She has a lot of enthusiasm, a deep love for our mission. And I'm really excited to see the way that we grow with her leadership.
I totally agree that she has very big shoes to fill, but I think she's the right person for the right job. Just like I think that you're the right person for the right job right now at the Montrose Center.
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate that.
Can you talk about maybe your future vision for the center? What are your plans?
You know, the commitment I made when I joined the center 7 months ago now was to listen for the first 12 months. I'm still in my listening phase. My first 6 months really focused intensely on listening to my staff and getting to know all of them. There's almost 100 staff. That's a lot of folks to get to know. And then you add in folks who are interns and fellows and volunteers. So it's a big community of folks who are making change through the center. This next many months, up to a year, will be focused on intentional listening in the community and with the community. And I've already started that in some ways one-on-one, but we are going to launch a series of community listening sessions, about 13 of them, with various focused community groups. So I'm really excited for that and how that will inform my understanding of where we need to go together. The other thing at our open house in June that we announced was the launch of a community advisory board. So that's going to be a permanent body, which is actually launching in October. We have a great group of folks who have applied to be on that community advisory board. And that's a way for us to keep the conversation going in a permanent fashion, for us to be constantly in conversation with the community directly about who we are now, but also who we want to continue to be together and where we want to go. My vision right now is that I'm going to continue to do that deep listening. And then after I've done that, I'm going to come back and do kind of a State of the Union address to the community and say, here's everything I've heard. And here's what I think that means about where we can go next together.
Let's go back to the Out for Good. It's happening October 5th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Marriott Marquis. Where can people get tickets for this event?
You go to our website, it's prominently featured there. If you type in Out for Good 2024 in your browser, it'll pop up there. And if you go to Instagram or Facebook, there are links and posts about the event on a regular basis. So lots of different ways to find tickets, sponsorship opportunities. This is such an important way to demonstrate support for the Montrose Center and our ongoing commitment to empowering our community. So we really hope that we shoot past our fundraising goal of $400,000. We're well on our way from the support we've received already. And we hope that the community comes together, rallies together, and helps us to not just meet that goal, but hopefully surpass it.
You're setting the bar high for Kelly.
We certainly are. She already jumped in, got to work right away. And of course, we already have an amazing team of folks who are very skilled at doing events. I think we do them very well. Malia and her team are very skilled at doing these events. So Kelly's very lucky. She came in with a very strong team.
Is there anything else you want our listeners to know about the Montrose Center or the Out for Good Gala coming up?
I would just say that if folks are listening to this and they're wondering about how they can be involved, how they can have a voice with where we're headed, I would say be on the lookout for the announcement of those community listening sessions. Some of them will be with small focused groups. Others will be open to larger groups. But we're really hungry to get everyone's opinion. I'm really hungry to do that deep listening. So please do, if you have something to say, I want to hear it. Good, bad, whatever it may be. I'm interested in what everyone has to say. So please do find a way to communicate that through one of those listening sessions or directly to me. And Out for Good, Saturday, October 5th, named Out for Good because it's the moment when we celebrate being out, right? National Coming Out Day is later that week. Out for Good is our opportunity to celebrate being out, to be our fabulous LGBTQ selves. And we certainly hope that the community will join us.
Thank you, Avery, for coming on. It's always a wonderful time talking to you.
My pleasure. This is Avery Bellew. My pronouns are she and her, and I am the CEO of the Montrose Center, Houston's LGBTQ+ center. And you are listening to Queer Voices, an integral part of Houston's LGBTQ+ community.
In November 2022, the National AIDS Memorial honored Cleve Jones with its Lifetime of Commitment Award. For anyone who doesn't know, Cleve is a legendary activist and mostly noted for his association with Harvey Milk and as a founder of the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and the force behind the Names Project AIDS Memorial Quilt. He's now about to turn 70 on October 11th, and there's a massive gala planned in celebration. Cleve, there's so much more than just that, as if that was not enough. Let's just talk a minute about the 70th birthday that's coming up on October 11th, which just happens to be National Coming Out Day.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And for your listeners, I'm speaking to you all from my little house out in the woods. I live up north of San Francisco now in Sonoma County. It's a spectacularly beautiful area where the redwood forests meet the vineyards. And there's a little town called Guerneville that's had a pretty significant gay community for quite a while now. And I'm living here, but I'm not retired yet. And I'm looking forward to this party on October 11th. It's a fundraiser for two organizations I co-founded, the National AIDS Memorial, which is the Quilt, and the AIDS Memorial Grove in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. And, of course, the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, which is our primary HIV/AIDS service provider, prevention education campaign. And it's going to be a big party. And I've promised everybody that there'll be no speeches.
And I understand people are coming from all over the country.
Yeah, it's really fun. Every day I check the ticket sales, and it's been quite touching to see how many people are willing to fly across a continent or an ocean to come. And I do appreciate it very much. It's been a difficult few years for, I think, many of us with COVID and everything. And for my cohort, if you will, of older gay men, you know, so few of my generation survived. So I think part of this is a celebration for all of us who are still here and still queer.
I will be 75 in January.
Oh, Lord, you're old. My God,
I know.
Girl, how do you get up in the morning?
But well, that's just it. I am one of the lucky ones. I get to get up in the morning.
Yeah.
Or sometimes at noon. But, you know, that's what we're seeing at this age, this generation, many of whom did not expect to live to be the age that you're turning. And of course, AIDS is still here.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because one of the things that was so distressing for me during COVID, aside from the fact that I was very frightened as a vulnerable senior who's had lung issues past, it was so frustrating to see so many of the same mistakes repeated. And I think it bears, you know, a little bit of attention that both pandemics started with a president in office who failed to perceive the gravity of the situation and who actually chose to mock and deride the people who were affected or concerned about it. Once again, we saw angry, uninformed parents storming school board meetings, demanding that their children be denied information that could save their lives. Once again, we saw huge debates about personal responsibility during AIDS, people refusing to use condoms, or during COVID, refusing to protect their neighbors by wearing masks. We also saw, of course, the terrible racial disparity play out once again. Black and brown people were likely to get infected, more likely sick, and likely die. There were other parallels, the spread of quackery and conspiracy theories. It was a difficult time for me and I think many others who had to go through a second pandemic within their lifetime. And of course, AIDS is not over. And when people ask me about my party, it's to benefit two organizations. One, the memorial, which is the Quilt and the Grove, is there to remind people, remember people we lost, and to remind people of mistakes that we made. And the AIDS Foundation today is also doing really good work every single day to try to keep those mistakes from being repeated, to make sure that our kids, especially the most vulnerable among them, are protected, get the education they need, get the medications they need, PrEP so they don't get HIV, and to advocate for them. So that's where I'm at right now, is remembering the past and doing my best to help people not repeat it.
Let's talk about this past a little bit, Cleve. First of all, you were young. I think you were still in your teens when you arrived in San Francisco. And the first night you're there, who do you meet?
Yeah, I had, I think, maybe $12. And I was hungry and I went to an all-night diner. It's long gone. It was called The Haven. It was at Polk in California. And bars had just gotten out. It was late at night. And I was so hungry. And there was only one place to sit. And it was across the table from this really wild-looking human being who turned out to be named Sylvester. Sylvester would go on to become the queen of disco. We were friends until he passed away. So part of the entertainment for my party is this performance from this incredibly talented guy in New York. His name is Anthony Wayne, and he has a show called Mighty Real. It's a tribute to Sylvester and his music. So the music of the man I met the first night I was in San Francisco will be played at my 70. Quite excited about it.
And then the legendary meeting with Harvey Milk. Tell me a little bit about that.
People always want to know, how did I meet Harvey? Well, I don't remember, but it was probably on Castro Street, and he was probably registering voters or passing out political literature. I didn't quite take him seriously. He still had a ponytail when I met him, and I thought he was a little old to be a hippie. He was funny. He was very funny. He always was making fun of himself, and he liked to dress up as a clown. He had a real charm, especially with the elderly and with kids. It was interesting. He really had a deep empathy and ability to connect with all sorts of people, but he had a special place in his heart for the older and the younger, and that manifested in his politics. He was very kind to me. He made me get serious about my life, and in between meeting him and really getting to work, I took a couple of years off and just went hitchhiking, which was kind of the thing then for hippie kids like myself. And I went hitchhiking around Canada and Europe and the Middle East, and stayed in touch with Harvey. And when I came back, he said, "You got to go to school and got to help. We've got a big fight coming." And so he persuaded me to enroll at San Francisco State in the political science department and got me an internship after he was elected. So I went with him to City Hall and went there for college credit.
I think maybe some of his example wore off on you, Cleve.
That's a very kind thing to say. Everything I am, everything I've done really goes back to Harvey. And the fact that we only had 11 months in office, and I was there that day in City Hall, November 27th, 1978, when he and our mayor, George Moscone, were murdered by Dan White. So I actually saw it. I didn't see the murder. I walked in about 10 minutes after it had happened. There was people to find his body. And that was the moment that just set my course forever. And I'm going to do with my life from that point.
Your memoir is called When We Rise, My Life in the Movement. And you have called it the movement that saved my life. Why do you say that?
Well, because it's true, and it's not rhetoric, it's not hyperbole. Where I'm sitting right now is a beautiful spot, and it's been friendly to LGBTQ people for decades now. But I guarantee that within a few miles of where I'm sitting, and where a few miles of where you're sitting, and where all of your listeners may be sitting, there is some kid who is getting ready to take their own life. Don't see a place for themselves in this world. They see no hope of love or happiness or anything. And it's because they fear that they're going to be rejected by their family, churches, their communities. And those kids kill themselves. And we've made a huge amount of progress. I'm grateful to have played a tiny role in it. We've done a lot. In my lifetime, I have seen a lot. But there are still queer and trans kids out there that are getting ready right now as we're talking to end their lives, who think their lives are over before they even began. And I was one of those kids. And I was stealing pills from my parents' medicine chest and getting ready to suicide. And then I read about gay liberation in Life magazine and discovered, you know, in one fell swoop that I wasn't alone, that there were other people, that there was a community of people like me, and that there was a movement that was part of the larger movement that my family already was part of, which was the movement for peace and social justice, the move against racism and war and poverty. That was life-saving, was life-changing. I threw away the pills and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. And then years and years later, you know, I got sick and I was getting close to death and didn't think I was going to make it at all. But ACT UP stormed the NIH and took on the pharmaceutical industry and fast-tracked the medications that saved my life and many, many thousands of others. So it's not rhetoric. The movement saved my life twice.
Our survival stories are what we give to the world because of you telling your story, because we do this radio show in part because we know those kids are out there, and this may be the only way they find community. You say there is a message in that if we are up to working together and to putting the work in, the movement that saved your life can can save America's too. And that seems very poignant for the time we're in right now.
Well, certainly we're in very challenging time. The country is very divided. There's a lot of anger, a lot of fear. It's not just our country. It's a phenomena that's increasing across the planet. And I think it's important to remember that ordinary people can change the world. Ordinary people can make decisions that will make it a healthier place for us all to live. And I believe in the power of people to do that work. And I am not, romanticizing it. I live in the real world. I live and work in the real world. For the last 20 years, I've worked mostly with a labor union called Unite Here, which represents approximately 300,000 hospitality workers around the United States and Canada. These are mostly women, mostly immigrant women, women of color. Think of the staff in the big hotels that you stay in when you're traveling. That's who I work for. And we take on some of the biggest corporations in the world, the Hyatt and Marriott and Hilton and large food service companies and big casinos in Las Vegas. And we win through collective bargaining. We win contracts and the workers go home with more money, better health care, work in safer conditions, treated with respect on the job. We lift families out of poverty, we transform their lives. That's not a romanticized version of what happens. And it's hard work. It takes sometimes years, but we do that work knowing that if we fight hard, we will win eventually, and we will improve the lives of our members and our communities. So I stay very grounded in the reality of hard work and strategic coalition building. And a lot of this for me goes back to Harvey, because Harvey won his office during a time when radical politics were very much in vogue. He wasn't preoccupied, though, with all of the buzzwords and the catchphrases. He was always looking for common ground. And this is something that's a little different these days, is it seems to me that many people are very much focused on all of the things that make us different from each other, all the boundaries and divisions that we create between each other, all these different subsets. But Harvey focused on what we had in common. And it's the same thing with my union. When we go into a big hotel property, want to organize the workers, we see at the lunch break, here's the Latino workers over here, here's the African-American workers over here, here are the white employees, here are the people from El Salvador, here are the people from Brazil, and here are the people from the Philippines. And they have their own separate tables, and they speak in their own language. But that's not the way we win. And the bosses use those divisions to weaken the workers. So in any organizing drive, one of the first things we have to do is get all these workers of different colors and ethnicities and faiths and political backgrounds to understand what they have in common. And that's how we build the movement. And I think that is something that is desperately needed in this country right now, to understand how much we have in common, how much we need each other. Where I live, we every year are under threat of wildfires and really horrendous flooding. So my neighbors, you know, we don't spend a lot of time arguing about politics when the hills are on fire or the river's rising. We got to take care of people, got to protect our homes. We've got to protect the pets and the livestock. We got to make sure that the senior citizens get out. It's like this is where we're at now. We're in a crisis and we need to find as much as possible. We need to find common ground in which we can build a consensus towards a more humane and also say practical politics. I know for sure there's also a lot of people in Houston who have no clue how many people died in Houston. Houston was devastated. And there are many, many, many hundreds of quilts that came out of Houston. There was also leadership. Someone who was our president of our board of directors for many years and raised enormous amounts of money was Jackson Hicks, whose home was often the gathering place for fundraisers and meetings, and put on a big, an enormous gala in Washington one of my days in association with the display. And I got to sit next to Ann Richards at that dinner, which was quite a treat. She was such a remarkable person. But yeah, Houston was hit very, very hard. And now I meet young LGBT folk from Texas, and they don't really know that history. It's unfortunate. And it's unfortunate I live in the real world. I'm not into romanticism or nostalgia per se, but the lessons of history are important. We do not know them, as I've said so many times, going to repeat those mistakes. And another thing I've been really concerned about We did change the world, and we did so hoping that a day would come when young people, people now called LGBTQ+, that they could grow up and take it for granted that they could marry the person they love, could take it for granted they could have the career that path that they want, take it for granted that they could walk down the street and not be beaten to death, to take it for granted that they had the right to vote, to take it for granted that they could participate as full citizens in this country. And sadly, we're not there yet. So I feel constantly the need to bang the drum and raise the alarm and say to people, if you take it for granted, they will take it away. Look at what happened with reproductive rights. We had generations of women growing up in this country knowing that they had the right to make that ultimate decision about their own bodies. And that has now been taken away. That's just the beginning. And so this election season is so crucial, but the challenge goes way beyond the choices on election day. Country is deeply divided. To be strong, we need to seek common ground whenever possible, but be willing to stand up for our principles.
Again, we're talking with Cleve Jones, legendary activist, movement leader, founder of the AIDS Memorial Quilt, and so much more. He's celebrating his 70th birthday on October 11th and having a big celebration in San Francisco. So just tell us again about that message of hope, courage, and love.
Well, I think what you're referring to is that when AIDS began, I was also attacked, badly beaten and stabbed and left to die. And I have to be honest, my heart at that point was really filled with despair and fear and hate. I didn't think I would survive. I felt that Mike was going to be destroyed. And I was very frightened of what would happen to my body, which it would hurt. And I hated the people that did this to us. I hated the bigotry and cruelty that had contributed so much to the suffering with HIV. And it's really thanks to the quilt and the movement that it represents that all of that despair and fear and hate was removed from my heart and placed with hope, courage, and love. And so I owe great debt to all of the people who picked up needle and thread and made my dream come true. Doing so helped change the world. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Cleve Jones, for changing the world, because indeed you have.
Hi, I'm Cleve Jones, and you are forming and participating in the LGBTQ+ community as you listen to this program. This is Queer Voices.
This is Brett Cullum, and today I am joined by actress Cheryl McCallum. Cheryl has been on Broadway in The Lion King and has an impressive list of credits behind her. But we're talking to her today because she teamed up with a co-creator named David Nels to produce and star in Miss Rhythm, The Legend of Ruth Brown. Now, this is a brand new show. It did play a little bit before, so it's not a premiere, but we are very lucky at Stages Houston to have her through October 13th. So Cheryl McCallum, welcome to Queer Voices.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor and a privilege and a pleasure. I'm glad I'm here.
Now, first, tell me really quickly who Ruth Brown is, because I think a lot of people don't recognize that name right off the bat.
Oh, gosh, Ruth Brown. She's this woman who came up in the, well, started recording in 1949. Her story, she was born back in, 1928, and through, in Portsmouth, Virginia. Her family was very religious, but she wanted to sing. And so she got introduced to the blues when she was visiting her grandmother in North Carolina, but just came through that whole system. And she's really, well, she's known for several things. One, she put Atlantic Records on the map back in the 50s, late 40s, early 50s. All the way probably through the early 60s, dropped off the planet for many reasons, and then had this resurgence when she went to go see Red Fox. And Red Fox knew about her from years ago. So she made all these wonderful connections. And then she started a resurgence and was in the original movie Hairspray, which a lot of people didn't know there was an original movie of Hairspray. Besides the Queen Latifah, or no disparaging for that, but they just didn't know. A woman of resilience, very strong personalities, fought for everything that she got, So with Hairspray, then she was in Black and Blue, got a Tony Award for Black and Blue, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's this woman that just came through a lot, but loved her music, loved her family, and just resilient beyond belief, and was able to live to see her flowers given to her. So she's a whole lot of woman. This story is just a small part of who she is.
Well, what made you and David want to write a show around her life? I know there was a book originally called Miss Rhythm. So
yes.
You two kind of get together and adapt that, or?
Well, David, first of all, we both used to live in New York. And David saw her perform a couple of times. One was at Blue Note and then at Le Jazza Bar. So David wrote this script about her performing at Le Jazza Bar, kind of like going back through time. So she's at Le Jazz, but then goes back and relives the story of her life and then ends up at Le Jazza Bar. It's a wonderful script. I still think he should do it at some point. But when he presented this to me, first he asked me, we were doing a show in Denver, and he asked, Cheryl, do you know Ruth Brown? I'm like, oh, yes, of course I know Ruth Brown. And then he presented the script. He said, I have something. I think you would be great to do it. But he presented this script, and this was actually a woman portraying her. It's just a me kind of thing. You know, I'm like, I don't look like her. I don't sound like her. I don't sing like her. But I said, David, if allowed, let's work on it in a different way where I can kind of jump in and out of her. And we went back and forth on that. But as far as what the script would look like. But I said, let's put it in my words and I'll tell her story and jump in and out of who she is. And that way we still get to tell her story. We get a semblance of who she is. I call it, let me just bring a little essence of Ruth. So we worked on that story, and that was kind of the beginning of all of this. And David is such a wonderful fan of Ruth Brown. I unfortunately never got to see her, but I know of many people who've worked with her. And just whenever I did see her, whether it's on TV, hear interviews, what a woman. My gosh, just powerhouse. So that's how it started. And through years, we developed it. It started as a cabaret show for this theater in Golden, Colorado called Miner's Alley during the pandemic. And so we were working on it before that, but this gave us time to really kind of fine tune it a little bit. And so Miner's Alley was trying to keep their audience engaged during the pandemic. So they had something called Quarantine Cabaret or Cabaret Quarantine. So David and I presented it hour long. I have a music stand and a book that I call the Book of Ruth. And he's way across the room in a very sanitized piano. And so that's how we started. And it just kind of grew from that. And some theaters saw it and said, if we can, we develop this a little more? And so that's how, just with some, a lot of work and everything. And that's how we got to bring it here to stages.
Well, it's funny because Stages is really known for musicals about artists, and they really kind of made their mark with Always Patsy Cline, and they did Lady Day. I mean, all of those different things. And when I saw your headshot, I thought, this woman does not look like Ruth Brown.
Exactly. And
I actually got kind of nervous going in thinking, oh my gosh, are you going to portray her and imitate her? Because I was thinking of she has a very distinctive, especially in Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean. She has a very trademark squeal. It's just crazy. And I'm like, I can't see anybody trying to do this because it's so rough under her voice. And I was so impressed when you came out and you were just Cheryl. You know, you weren't pretending to be Ruth. And it was so smart because I don't know if even Ruth could do Ruth at a certain point in her life, because
changed
so much from the 50s to the present, things like
that's
that.
Right.
And I think it's a very smart approach because it feels like it's a really good friend telling you about someone that she admires and adding it all of that. And it just felt so personal. And it's so different than watching somebody do an impersonation, because sometimes when they do that, you just kind of go, And it throws up this wall.
That's exactly why I think this works, because no one is trying to be her. We want to keep that feel. We want to give her essence. It's not me trying to be Ruth Brown. Just like you, it kind of throws a lot of people. It's like, she don't look like Ruth. She doesn't sound like her. That's good, because we're not trying to do that. We want to give, kind of keep it in the style of her music, but in, let you know what that music is. And I'm singing it as Cheryl. I do try to get those little squeals in every now and then, because that was her signature. And so, but I appreciate you saying that, because that's what we were going for. And a lot of people don't really understand it until they're in it. It's like, oh, okay, I got you.
One thing that's funny is that I knew Ruth mainly because of John Waters' original Motormouth Maybelle. John always led me to 50s music because he always used those in his soundtrack. So I found Ruth through that. Yes. And I was very into all of the 50s stuff. And I so appreciate that you do so much of her 50s catalog. It's so much fun. But I think a lot of the LGBTQIA plus community knows her because, let's face it, drag queens love Ruth. I cannot tell you. I think weekly somebody does. If I can't sell it, I'm going to keep sitting on it. So it's funny. It's a, she's kind of an icon in our world.
Absolutely. And that, yeah. And that's how people started rediscovering who she was, because the drag community and the, you know, the LGBTQ plus would follow John Waters, of course, Divine. And that's not to say anything in the story, but that's when Ruth got this whole new resurgence. And a lot of it is in part to the gay community and how they started researching her and finding out who she is and bringing back those old songs from the 50s. That's why she was able to go strongly against Atlantic Records and start getting her royalties and to continue that lawsuit because of Hairspray. Because people would know. And the funny thing about Hairspray, which I'm sure you know, she didn't sing. John Waters wanted her because of her personality and her, you know, just her appearance and her, yeah, her personality. Didn't sing a note. From that, I'm telling you, it gave her a whole new audience.
I read somewhere that in Denver, you couldn't get the rights to the song, "If I Can't Sell It, I'll Keep Sitting on It." But in this Houston run, it's in there. So
it is.
Yeah. Is it hard to get the rights to a lot of these songs? Was that a chore?
Yes, because they're owned through the years by different people. And then some agencies sell their rights to other people, not other people, but to another agency, and it moves down the line. So we hired, I guess he won't mind me saying his name, Jamie Rocco, to do that research and get us our rights. But with I Can't Sell It, it was difficult to get it in Denver because two people claimed 100%. And it's like, no. And so we didn't get them. But somehow with this production and for those types of houses, and I'm saying families or houses, I think one is owned by a family, one is owned by a corporation, that the first time they're like, no. And then once they see it happening again, they're thinking, maybe we need to rethink this. But I'm glad we got it. It's just,
I am too. It's definitely a moment in the show that I was just smiling so big because I was like,
yay.
Do you have a favorite in the show? Do you have one that you like go, oh my gosh?
Oh gosh. There's so many. I love Be Anything. And it's just not me on that. We have a gorgeous sax solo by Brett Neighbors. And so that one is a favorite of mine. I've come to love So Long, and we do it very differently than she does, just in the context of the show. Gosh, Teardrops. And I love Oh, What a Dream. I just like them all. I like them all.
Well, you can tell when you perform them, you can tell.
Yeah.
You
keep loving. And Mama is a lot of fun.
Cabbage Head. I was like, why isn't everybody singing this song?
You know what? And when we first did it, we didn't do Cabbage Head, just for time constraints. And then a friend of mine, he said, Cheryl, why didn't you put Cabbage Head in? And that's one that I didn't know. So I went back and I listened to it. I'm like, David, why isn't Cabbage Head in here? He says, I was hoping that you'd say that because I love Cabbage Head. I don't know why we didn't put it in the cabaret version, but it's in now and it's not going away.
Now, how did this show end up at Stages? I mean, it's kind of amazing that it's here.
Yes, the Ken McLaughlin, who was the old artistic director, he and David go way back. And I met Ken when he did a show in Denver, actually in Arvada, that he wrote, I think he and David wrote, called I'll Be Home for Christmas. And so I auditioned for that. I got in for that. I met Ken. And David already had a wonderful relationship with him. So when he found out we were doing this show, he came down to see it and thought that it would really be good in this space. And it was also not tricky, but this was his last season at Stages. So he got to set the last season. He came down and saw it and liked it, presented it to Stages. Then Ebony Darcy came down and she agreed. And so they pushed it and that's how it wound up here at Stages. And we're glad the new artistic director, Derek, has a connection with Ruth too. He was working in New York and he said, listen, I took a night off and I went to go see Black and Blue. He has a connection with her. So we're just glad it's working, but that's how it wound up at Stages. So I'm glad. Yay.
I am too. No, definitely. So what is next for Miss Rhythm? I mean, what do you hope kind of happens from here?
Well, we just want to keep getting her word out and getting the word, not so much about the show. Yes, the show, but for her, because she's such a dynamic woman and her story needs to be told. A lot of these stories about women of that day and age are missing. I mean, we know about the Etta James and Billie Holiday, but stories like her, where they did get to survive to see it, to see their, as I say, to get their flowers, are stories that need to be heard. The director, Kenny Moten, talks about it in a Hidden Figures sort of way, where you don't know that you didn't know until you knew. And then you go back and discover all these wonderful things. So what we hope is that people, number one, tell their friends to come out and see it here. And we'll keep getting the word out. We have some other theaters interested. And then her family, her son, Ronnie McFadder, and her nephew, Damon Williams, are also so much behind it. And that meant a lot to us to be able to have them on board because we just couldn't go through with it without them. It just makes the whole process so much better. So that's our hope, is that A, people come out to see it. We'll be running through October 13th and invite your friends, invite your family.
You know, she really fought hard for artists' rights, Ruth Brown. And I love that in the show, when I look up and you have her initials up on the video screens, it's literally R&B.
That's right.
Literally R&B. Right R&B. There, Rhythm and Blues. And you just think that there's some kind of destiny there. And
that's right.
It's so neat. And this, the legacy. Do you see anything in today's music that reminds you of Ruth?
So many artists. I mean, from Mary J., one writer said, you know, there wouldn't be a Beyonce without a Ruth Brown. But I think her influence is just, I mean, Tina, just that hard driving rhythm that was her. And then also in the 50s, she sang these lovely ballads that were just heart-wrenching. And then she sang everything from blues. She even did a spirituals album back in the day. But there's so many influences of her. So I think, you know, I just see just that hard driving, pounding, the essence of that old school rhythm and blues. But, you know, I see Mary J. definitely. Yeah.
Well, Miss Rhythm, the legend of Ruth Brown, runs at Stages through October 13th. They have a great website where you can buy tickets. And a secret tip for me is that if you go during the week, it's a little bit discounted, but it's a perfect show for the weekend. It's awesome. And it's great for groups Or you can do it like me and just go solo and just hang out there. It's such a warm, inviting, wonderful experience. And it's definitely something that I'm going to see again. Make all my friends learn about Ruth Braille because they
all
look
right. That's right. There's something in that show for everybody, and just how Stages has taken such wonderful care in curating this show.
Yeah. Well, it's a very unique experience. And thank you so much for bringing it to us here in Houston and at Stages. It's a great chance to see and learn a little bit about somebody who's legendary, and you are as well. I mean, your voice, just amazing, and so much fun to see you take on this, gosh, this library of music from this woman. I can't even count how many are in the show. It's like it just
a whole lot. No. And the band is just spectacular, and there's, you know, it's just a joy to do every night, and you come off the stage dripping and sweating, but it's okay.
Well, thank you so much for taking this time with me. I could talk Ruth Braille all day.
Me too.
Go and get your thing, and I'll let everybody else go and get their tickets.
Fabulous. Thank you for having me again, Brett. It's so wonderful to be with you.
That was Brett Cullum in conversation with actress Sherry McCollum about the Stages Houston show called The Legend of Ruth Braille.
I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Melanie Keller.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 14th, 2024. The largest LGBTQ pride march in Serbia's history had several thousand people marching through the capital of Belgrade on September 7th. They were not deterred by threats of violence from right-wing extremists or the recent attack on a young gay man for carrying a rainbow flag. Banners urged marchers to love and be brave. The procession was protected by a heavy police presence. Government protection from such verbal and physical violence has been a key pride demand for years. Blatant discrimination routinely plagues sexual and gender minorities in the socially conservative Balkan nation. Despite record Pride March turnouts both last year and this, demands for the legal recognition of same-gender couples and laws protecting the rights of transgender people have gone ignored. It's a major reason why Serbia's bid to join the European Union has stalled. Several ambassadors from Western countries led contingents in the march. Of course, there was plenty of dance music blasting from large trucks and lots of chanting and waving rainbow flags. Politicians from opposition political parties and a few of the Serbian government's more progressive members joined in. More banners proclaimed, "No one is free until everyone is free. Love wins, and homophobia is so boring." A small, boring group in the center of the city protested the Pride March behind a banner reading, "Parade Humiliation." They also carried Serbian Orthodox Church symbols and Serbian flags. Dozens of Russians fleeing the oppressive regime of Vladimir Putin and his war on Ukraine found a home in Belgrade's Pride March. A concert and after-party followed the march.
A gay male couple in Zimbabwe is sorry about getting the police involved during their messy breakup. Now each faces up to a year in prison for sodomy. Prosecutors say that Tavimbanashe Shawatama and Leonard Nyakadaya moved in together last year, but had a falling out in August over issues of infidelity. As Nyakadaya was moving out, Shawatama accused him of stealing money. They went to the Harare police station over the alleged theft, but their cell phones revealed recordings of them having sex. That's a violation of Section 73I of the country's penal code, a remnant of British colonial era rule. It outlaws what it calls any act involving physical contact that would be regarded by a reasonable person to be an indecent act. Those convicted of sodomy are liable for a fine and/or imprisonment for a year. LGBTQ advocacy groups note that the police ignored the issue of the missing money that had prompted Chawatama and Nyakadaya to seek their help in the first place. They've each been released on the equivalent of $50 US bail.
The Australian Bureau of Statistics will include questions about sexual orientation and gender identity in its 2026 census. The ruling Labour Party had made a campaign promise to conduct an inclusive census. However, officials had apparently ended up omitting any LGBTQ questions in a misplaced desire to avoid a culture war controversy. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese responded to the widespread criticism from queer rights groups and his own Labour Party last week, saying that questions about sexual orientation had been added. The absence of questions about gender identity prompted renewed criticism. That issue was addressed, and Treasurer Jim Chalmers updated Australian Bureau of Statistics policy again late this week during an interview on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
The message that we want to ensure that Australians hear from us today is that we understand the feedback that we got. We listened to that. We took it very seriously. We listened very genuinely. We said that we would find the best way to do this, and I believe that we have and we will. And the ABS will continue to refine the actual wording of the questions now that this additional topic has been added.
There's still another painful omission, one that Intersex Human Rights Australia CEO, Dr. Morgan Carpenter, finds devastating. In his words, it means we won't get much needed information on the health and well-being of people with innate variations of sex characteristics.
Australia is making more gender identity news this week with an independent study commissioned by the state of New South Wales. The report concluded that the benefits of puberty blockers and other reversible treatments for transgender young people far outweigh any potential drawbacks. That flies in the face of the UK's controversial CAS report, which reached the opposite conclusion. Under Britain's Tory government, the CAS report was used to temporarily ban pediatric gender-affirming treatment in England, Scotland, and Wales. The incoming Labour Party government has signaled that it will make those restrictions permanent. The Sachs Institute is an independent nonprofit that advocates for evidence-based healthcare solutions. That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending September 14th, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, with thanks this week to Barry McKay. Produced by Brian DeShazer and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Melanie Keller. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay safe.
This has been Queer Voices, heard on KPFT Houston and as a podcast available from several podcasting sources. Check our webpage, queervoices.org, for more information. Queer Voices executive producer is Brian Levinka. Deborah Moncrief Bell is co-producer. Brett Cullum and David Mendoza Druzman are contributors, and Brett is also our webmaster. The News Wrap segment is part of another podcast called This Way Out, which is produced in Los Angeles.
Some of the material in this program has been edited to improve clarity and runtime. This program does not endorse any political views or animal species. Views, opinions, and endorsements are those of the participants and the organizations they represent. In case of death, please discontinue use and discard remaining products.
For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
The Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council present the story of Tom and Levi.
Tom is the smartest man I know. He's been a professor at two major universities, been a teacher for over 40 years. One day, he told me that he was having problems in his classes. I think one of the students had asked the question and he didn't remember the answer. And I also noticed that he was letting his class out earlier than they were supposed to let out. And he was telling them that he was doing it as a favor to them, but I think in reality, he just wanted to get out of there. I was really starting to worry because I saw something was wrong.
Levi and I talked about how it would change our lives, but he was there beside me, and my love for him was just immense.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Hello, My name is Marcus, and I'm the host of a new one-hour program that will air at 7 o'clock on Saturday mornings. Some of my earliest memories involve hearing a transistor radio in my dad's garage and grandmother's kitchen in the early 1970s. On those radios, there were two types of music that played, country and western. I want to use this program to take you, the listener, back to that Southeast Texas garage.